An international group of scientists says the high temperatures in the U.S. Southwest are the result of climate change. World Weather Attribution studies the causes of extreme weather. It says the month's heat wave would have been virtually impossible without human-caused climate change. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. This is NPR.
Welcome, friends, to The Conversation on WVIK, a weekly celebration of local radio the way it's meant to be brewed. This week, my guest is Jack Dane of Bettendorf, Iowa, and Points Beyond. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll stick around for this week's Conversation on WVIK. Well, Jack, I think your voice is very well known to many a WVIK listener because you've been very generous as a member of the Challengers Circle, you and Michelle, but also by doing some of the most memorable listener testimonials that I've heard on these airways. Jack, welcome.
Thank you, Kai.
It's great to have you here. I know you're a busy, busy person, and we've got all kinds of things to talk about, but one I'd like to start with is that, probably inconsequential part of your life before you and I met. We've been friends now for a good 20-plus years, I think. We were introduced by a mutual friend, and then through the auspices of, I think, Bettendorf Kiwanis, we...
Do you remember where we met?
You're going to have to tell me.
It was at the Arsenal Country Club. It was for an artful affair.
An artful affair.
And I was just telling Rob Lipnick it would be great to do that again because the art was fantastic. I have many pieces from that. I think it was successful for WVIK, not that you need to raise money.
Well, as you know, Jack, that's funny you should mention. This is the spring fund drive, and the money that the federal government took away last fall has not come back. So we are working at filling that gap, and you can help out in an artful manner. 309-794-7500. Amber is here at the studio this morning making sure that those calls are answered. Or if this is during the rebroadcast Monday evening, you can always go to wvik.org. So let's start there, Jack, but I do want to get back to your earlier biography. The Artful Affair was a great thing that Don and some others cooked up, and there were fantastic art. And Lipnick, I just loved the stuff he would offer, and so many others, Bill Hannon, of course, and great local artists pitching in for public radio.
Yes, and I was telling Rob that I think there was almost fisticuffs over one of those silent auction sheets that somebody would come in and write a number down, and then somebody else would come and write a number down over one of his works. I have one of the Hannon works as well.
As I hazily recall, the fisticuffs is not out of line because it was pretty alcohol-soaked because that got more generous pledges, I think, and contributions. But some of those great events and held at the Arsenal Country Club—
Which is soon to be gone.
Soon to be gone, consigned to the memories of, fond memories of many. But there were quite a few fun things like that. I remember bringing Scott Simon in, bringing in Bob Edwards. More recently, we got Cokie Roberts. But those were some heady days for our community's public radio station. I'm glad you were a part of them.
It was great to see Cokie Roberts here. She was quite a tribute to public radio, really.
I listed as one of my fondest memories was buying red wine for Cokie Roberts. I bought her a drink. So also, I didn't have to buy it for Edwards, but part of the stipulation was that someone from the station be assigned to make sure the bourbon in front of him was never completely out. And so that was my task. And we took good care of Bob Edwards that night. But before meeting you, it's remarkable that we hadn't met through other circles, because even though you're not originally from the Quad Cities, you are deeply steeped in and woven into the fabric of this community. But let's talk about the before times. Where'd you grow up?
Grew up in Iowa City on a dairy farm. The dairy farm is outside of Iowa City, but now surrounded by Iowa City, mm-hmm. right above mm-hmm. the airport. And mm-hmm. and really, a lot of my time was spent in a little business that my parents started to sell milk originally, and then the milk was less of a commodity than the ice cream. So Dane's Dairy is still a thing, going 60 years strong. It's where I got my first job, boxing eggs, because eggs would come in, I don't know, 16 or 32 dozen in a carton, and you had to move them into a dozen at a time. And if I did that without breaking one, I got an ice cream cone.
Hey, that's a pretty good incentive. Yeah. So were those sold or used in the ice cream manufacture?
Sold through. So
okay.
We sold butter, eggs, milk,
yeah.
ice cream.
Yeah. And it is really the case that now Iowa City has surrounded the farm. Are there still cows on the farm?
Not anymore. The
Not
dairy,
anymore.
Dairy actually went in the early 80s, and my brother had come back to do a dairy business, but the economics were not good. They've been very poor for dairy farmers in terms of the swings in price are very high and then very low. There are a lot of farms in Iowa that went by the wayside in that. I had been recruited to talk about Iowa to a maybe the Russian embassy or a group of Russians in Moscow. They're doing every state. And so I was recommended to talk about Iowa. So I was trying to figure out what would be interesting.
Is this upcoming or you recently did this?
It's in May. So I'm still doing my research. Anything you want to tell me about Iowa that I can
Well, you grew up in Iowa City, but then you went away to school. Tell us about that.
I went to a boarding school. It was military when my dad went there, when my brother went there, and it was military when I started there, but was no longer military by the time I left there. It's just a prep school called Shattuck St. Mary's, and it has become a little bit more famous because of its hockey program
there. Well, tell us about that. Yeah. I've heard from you, but I want to hear more.
Well, there are quite a few. There were 10 or more hockey players in the Olympics that went to my high school. Sid Crosby did, and Jonathan Taves did, and the women's hockey program is really more unique because there's a lot more boys programs than there are girls programs
sure,
out there.
Sure, sure.
But we also do, I'm on the board at the high school, so I am involved in going back and watching the soccer players. The golf program is big. The music program is big. They've got vocal and instrumental programs. Bioscience, they've got aviation. I think we even have a sharpshooter who's in training there from Italy. I think he's from Italy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what a fascinating place. And that's in Minnesota.
In Faribault, Minnesota. Faribault was settled very early on as the immigration moved north, and the state schools, deaf, blind, mm-hmm. and for the mentally deficient, or whatever they call it these days. It's where Bill Sachter was in Faribault, Minnesota, before it was a made-for-TV movie.
Oh, yeah.
Mickey Rooney.
Legend of Iowa City.
Yeah, and he then moved to Iowa City when they finally figured out that he was just a regular guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, but a lot of history in Faribault before the Twin Cities took over.
Well, if you don't mind, I'm just curious about this. From a dairy, I mean, you normally expect people to go to boarding school schools, military academies from very old, staid families in Connecticut and New Hampshire and that sort of thing. How does it land from a dairy farm in Iowa City to a prestigious academy?
I think that my connection was really through my grandfather's first wife went to St. Mary's.
And okay.
He was introduced to the school then, wanted his boys to go there. He was a military man. Graduated from University of Minnesota back in the days when ROTC was mandatory. I think his contemporary might have been Eric Severide, and I saw a biography of Eric Severide for one of his first stands was against mandatory ROTC at the University of Minnesota. It was required at most colleges. Even, I think, Grinnell College, where I went to school, had an ROTC program. Most places did.
And well, I think that might have been, I don't know, the history at Augustana, they didn't have one. There was a little more of a pacifist streak from the old Swedish Lutherans. But our president, Andreen, during World War I, he started one, but I don't think it was compulsory. I think it was just a branch to get it started.
So. And I would agree with the Swedish pacifist, or maybe even Scandinavian pacifist, because Eric Severide would have been
of he would that. Have been in that. You know, here's a little aside. He wrote a book. He, as a young man with his brother, went canoeing up into the northern reaches of Minnesota and into Canada, and he wrote a memoir called Canoeing with the Cree, and being part of Cree cultures and visiting villages and that sort of thing. And a Rock Islander, Rob Humphrey, who's been on this show, at one time he was a filmmaker, and he and his filmmaking buddies bought the screen rights. Wouldn't that be interesting to see a film about Eric Severide as a young man canoeing with the Cree?
It would.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so we get you to Shattuck, St. Mary's, and you do amazing things there. But at that time, I'm always interested, when people are in high school, some things start to come into focus and some things sort of fade out into the periphery and are no longer options. What was that process like for you in high school? Did you start to see a path before you, or are you going to hold off till college?
I was involved in debate, and I was involved a little bit in politics in high school, but politics became more of a focus as I came into college. I became a avid supporter of Jim Leach, our mm-hmm. former congressman mm-hmm. from Davenport, certainly a standalone man in the Republican Party. He was standing alone at the end.
At the end, he was. That's right.
And certainly somebody who believed in bipartisanship, believed in having a inclusive Republican Party that included a lot of different thoughts and ideologies, and. In that regard, he was much more moderate. I would say he was progressive. And I chuckle when I read the newspaper. There isn't a lot of ways to figure out what people are saying, but the letters to the editor are always very funny to read. And I was reading one this week about those darn Democrats. Dan Lee. I was like, Dan Lee is no Democrat, and we supported him when he ran for Congress as a Republican a couple of times here.
1982, I think, somewhere in there, yeah.
I think 82 might have still been Railsback, but after that, 84, 86.
Okay, that sounds about right. Now, where did you go to college?
Grinnell.
That's what I thought. So just when you mentioned Jim Leach, one of my favorite memories of working here back in the newsroom in the 80s and 90s is, the general manager and founder at the Don Wooten has a bit of an aura around him as well. And yes. I will remember that, you know, we would have to work every holiday and it was a Christmas break. So the college was very quiet and Jim was back in town and he and Don just got together in the break room and just had the most wide ranging conversation. And those of us on staff were just, you know, I could have done my editing back in the newsroom, but I decided to bring it over to the break room and just kind of be a fly on the wall. But those are some great memories. And it is too bad that that party doesn't exist anymore. I just noticed in this week's Illinois primary, someone that I, in other times would not have been considered a moderate Republican. Noreen Hammond, a state rep from a district southeast of here, she lost to a very committed follower of Donald Trump and the MAGA movement. And so there's a seat that's probably going to tilt hard to the right. And he won by calling her a moderate. So that's a badge of shame, apparently, now in that party. And it's a sad thing to see. So we get you to college. Did you decide to major in politics then? Or?
No. I was an economics and American studies major, right. Although I did take – I enjoyed the social sciences and history and political science were also areas that I liked to take courses in. And Grinnell has very little structure, but I hit one of its structural limits, and that is of the 124 credits you need to graduate, only 92 could be in one of the three disciplines, social science, humanities, or science. And so I was taking some other courses at the end, including Spanish, which I'm still not very good at, and logic, which is a humanity because it's in philosophy.
That's right. Part of the original core arts. Right. What were some other – I always am fascinated by the classes people took that weren't in their major that they still find fruitful today. Do you have an example of that?
I would say that the history is something that I really enjoy. And so as much as I can read it, see it, and hear it, history is fascinating to me. So
right.
I do enjoy our local history. I enjoy the WVIK aspects of recounting our local history. My office is in the KSTT building, which a lot of people know is another radio station. And because I didn't grow up here in the Quad Cities, KSTT was completely unknown to me. We had to wait until the sun went down, and then WSUI, my public radio station from Iowa City, would go down, and we could pick up WLS in Chicago.
Right, right.
And they kind of overlapped on their band.
Those were known as the clear channel stations. And even when I started at WVIK, that was something you had to do on the log. After the sun went down, you had to power down a little bit, and then you could power back up in the heat of the day. And I even did a little stint over at WOC, which was a clear channel AM station. They didn't have to, I think they ramped things up at night, and it could be heard probably in New Mexico, for all I know. But there was a limited bandwidth for that. But that building, I'm glad you mentioned it, because you are in a law practice. We'll get you through law school and all that kind of stuff. And there's a lot of places that you could potentially alight with something like that. What is it that attracted you to this building, which is on a bend on River Drive? And many of us know it for the former site of the old Robin Hood flower, and then the silos with Twinkie the Kid painted on them. And of course, we think back to Spike Odell and other greats who were at KSTT, Kick 104, all those kinds of things. What attracted you to this historic building?
Well, I was looking for office space, and that building had just been rehabbed and redone by Mark Engelman. Did a wonderful job, and he grew up. He was a KSTT kid, and he had saved all of his top 40 lists or whatever KSTT handed out every week, and he created a one of the conference rooms that we have is called the Spike Room because it's dedicated to Spike Odell.
Yeah.
And the other thing I want to say about that radio station and about all radio stations is that back in the day, it was required. I think it was the public trust doctrine, whatever, that allowed a radio station to use the airwaves.
Mm-hmm.
The requirement was that they have a news department. So KSTT, like every radio station, had an actual active energetic news department. One of my favorite pictures is one of the reporters interviewing Everett Dirksen, and there are pictures of them covering John Kennedy's visit in when he was running for president, and Nixon's visit, and so we don't have that anymore. I think it was 1990. We had a press conference when Charlotte Moore resigned as the head of the chairman of the Scott County Republican Party, invited the press to come, and there were five or six press people that came because the radio stations and the news stations all had people that covered local news. And that's not true anymore. It's only WVIK in my mind.
It's almost like you're teeing up a pledge. But as we remember, 1170 on your AM dial, we celebrate the fact that 90.3 FM is there in the Quad Cities. And it does have a newsroom. You're making me remember Tony Little, who was the KSTT guy. John Bauman from WOC was always around. Max Molliston, just great legends. But today we've got these other amazing folks like Brady Johnson and Joseph Lee here at the WVIK newsroom. They are racking up awards like nobody's business. And having that access to the stories of our community is important. And if it's important to you folks who are listening right now, even if you're listening Saturday morning or the rebroadcast Monday evening, you can make a pledge because this is our spring fund drive, 309-794-7500 or WVIK.org.
Kai, what's it take to be in the Challenger Circle? Because one of my thoughts is that you really don't promote that. There's a lot of people out there that would like to be mentioned from time to time as being really stellar underwriters.
Yeah.
And they want to join the Challenger Circle. Who do they talk to?
They talk to Amber. So here's what I'm going to tell you. There's so many ways to do that. You can buy a day. You know, if you give a certain amount, you can get a day's worth of underwriting. I tried to do my most recent one in honor of Herb Trix's birthday. That's a great way to do it. If you can become a sustaining member during this drive, at $10, I think you get a really cool WVIK umbrella. They had a few of those Power to the Public shirts, the long sleeve WVIK logoed shirt for $15. The key is, it's not so much the bottom line, it's that sustaining membership, which means so much. It means that Jared Johnson and the crew and Mindy on the music side, we can look ahead 12, 15, 18 months and have a better sense of what's going on because there's been so much uncertainty. I do remember, Jack, those days before the legislation changed when there was a commitment by broadcasters to the community in which they live. That's changed. Most of the radio that you find spooling up and down your dial right now emanates from a closet-sized room in Orlando, Florida, Albuquerque, New Mexico, or you fill in the blank. These are satellite services that have sort of nudged out the folks that we grew up with, the legends that we grew up with. And with that, I mean, that's created a great deal of shareholder profit for some corporations. But it's removed some of the profit that communities used to be able to count on, and that is the social capital that you get from a station that's based right there. So before our time is done, I'm going to have to ask you to give the phone number and make sure you've got your paces down. But you can always talk to Amber, 309-794-7500. She'll tell you all the ways that you can support it. Right now, though, we are talking with Jack Dane, and we've got a lot of things to cover. We're going to take just a little bit of a break here in just a moment. And thank you, Jack, for so generously teeing up that. But friends, we want you to stay tuned because, among other things, the Dane family and Dane's Dairy has a very pivotal part to play in bringing writers, poets, thinkers from around the world right here to our community in Iowa City. They occasionally, they pop over and check out the Mississippi River. But that's the International Writing Program. We're going to learn more about that. And we're going to also learn about the inveterate exploration that this fella does. Jack and Michelle Dane, they travel all over the place. We want you to stay tuned as the conversation continues on WVIK. As aforesaid, now's a great time to make a pledge of support. Go over to WVIK.org and you can take care of it right there. We'll be back in just a moment with the conversation on WVIK and a chat with Jack Dane.
Support for WVIK comes from River Action, presenting their annual Henry Farnham Dinner on March 26th at 5 p.m. This year's presentation will explore the history of John Deere with archivist, researcher, and author Neil Dahlstrom. Registration is at riveraction.org.
Kick off your weekend with What's Happening QC, your guide to concerts, festivals, and events around the Quad Cities, made possible by Seifert Building Supplies. Fridays at 8:01 a.m. on WVIK Classical. And remember, subscribe to What's Happening QC wherever you get your podcasts. What's Happening QC?
My name is Sam Pilcher from Davenport, Iowa, and I get my news from WVIK.
And welcome back to The Conversation on WVIK, and this week, a chat with Jack Dane. And I knew we were going to wander all over the place, but before we get away from this, tell us more about these changes in legislation and how they affected radio in communities like ours.
Well, I was commenting on the public trust doctrine, which required that there be a actual news department in every radio station and TV station. But the other doctrine we've walked away from is the fairness doctrine, which is the one that requires that you provide equal time and that you have both viewpoints. And it's the elimination of the fairness doctrine that really allowed for the creation of Fox News.
MMSN. I mean, yeah, exactly.
That you can make money by selling an editorial viewpoint through the news.
Well, I will take it a step further than that and ask for your opinion on this. It's about making money from fear and anger, because if you can get someone fearful and angry, and personally, I believe that anger is just fear with lipstick on it to make it socially acceptable. If you can get people there, they're going to hand over money to your candidate. That's why so many people jockey for a few minutes of airtime on Fox, MSN, whether on the right or left side of the spectrum, because they know if they're a candidate or an office holder, their coffers will swell for every moment they can hack people off on either side. And that's why I think public radio has a place that needs protecting, because there's no shareholder value here. We just, we're accountable to the kid in Silvis and the older person in Davenport. And that's what we do, is we make sure they're equally informed.
That's right. And fear does drive a lot of that media. And we see it on the rest of the media as well. I'm not a big gun proponent, and it always bristles me when I see the commercial that says be prepared, not scared, because that commercial's meant to make you scared.
Of course. Well, anyway, I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole, because we still have some talking about things to do here. So after college, did you go immediately to law school? Or?
Yes, I moved back to the farm and attended law school. My wife, Michelle, attended College of, it's College of Public Health now. It was in the College of Medicine at the time. It was a healthcare and hospital administration program. And there she got her master's, and that's what brought us to the Quad Cities, because her internship in her senior year or second year of her master's program was at a place called Moline Public Hospital. Hmm. There she worked for her good friend Ruth Lee, and that's how we got to know the Quad Cities, and that's what brought me over here to look for a job. And I started the week after I graduated, or passed the bar, and back then you could take the bar and be sworn in the same week. Now it's a little longer process.
Was it an established firm, or when did you go off on your own?
I went to work with Fred Berger, Gary Lane, and Fred's been and Shirley have been in the challenge circle since it was established, I believe. And they were leaders in the community in a lot of regards, Quad City Arts and WVIK in particular.
Well, you were a smart man to follow that, Michelle, I'll tell you what. And I don't know if you knew this, but my stepdaughter went through the hospital administration program at Iowa, and she managed to stumble into an internship at Presbyterian in Manhattan, New York Presbyterian, had a great experience, and she she's now come back. She's at the university hospitals have a center for developmental medicine for children, and she's now helping with that. So
that's great. So
near and dear to my heart, too.
Got grandkids back in Iowa.
That's right, and it's an excuse to go to Iowa City, and you gave me a fantastic excuse to go to Iowa City last summer and have an amazing meal. Tell us about your family's relationship to the International Writing Program.
Well, my parents were farmers, but my dad was a very public-minded. He ran for supervisor and didn't win that spot and as a Republican and lost by 7 votes in the very Democratic Johnson County. But he was on the school board. He was president of the school board for many years and was involved in bridge clubs. They had their duplicate bridge clubs that were professors and doctors and everybody in Iowa City. So they had a lot of friends in Iowa City. And there was a couple that came to the university from Uganda. Idi Amin had given the Asians, they were of Goan descent, gave them 24 hours to get out of the country.
Right,
so they ended up at Iowa, and he taught African literature there. But he said, I'm here in Iowa and I don't know any farmers. So my parents were the designated farmers and they became friends of this couple and good friends. They came up and visited me even when I was in at Shattuck in Minnesota. So it was through that connection that my parents started hosting a Thanksgiving dinner for international writers that come to Iowa City.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an offshoot that Paul Engel had founded. He was with the Iowa Writing Program. Everybody knows the Iowa Writers Workshop, John Irving and Kurt Vonnegut and
W.P. Kinsella, Bharati Mukherjee, I think, might have. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
The list is just too long to start on. But the International Writing Program was to bring writers, poets, screenwriters from around the world to a 10-week program in Iowa City where they would meet and they have classes. But we hope that they kind of coalesce as a group as well, that they kind of feed off of each other. And it's been interesting. We've had people we used to have writers from Russia, which we don't have currently. We used to have writers from Hong Kong, which are a little bit more difficult for them to do anything anymore under their political regime.
Yeah, I was very impressed, and thank you again for the kind invitation to come out. And Jenny and I got to join. It's a wonderful farm meal, so they get a healthy dose, a heapin' helpin' of what it's like to experience Iowa hospitality. But I was fascinated as they went around and introduced themselves. Here's a person from Israel next to a person from Iran. Here's a person from Pakistan next to a person from India. There was someone from China. I think there was someone that might have been from Taiwan or anyway, it was just fascinating. All these, and they're mostly young people by my standards, you know, and it was just so neat to see them there. The program almost petered out, right?
Well, it lost almost $1 million of funding from the federal government as the federal government decided that soft diplomacy was not where we're going to spend the $200 billion of funds that are being asked for this week.
Yeah.
That it's no diplomacy, it seems.
Right.
The things that we all thought were sacrosanct in terms of international policy and international relations are kind of tossed aside at this point.
Well, if we keep getting political, Jack, and I appreciate the invitations, but this week's news included that China's BYD automaker, which is their leading electric vehicle maker, now has perfected a battery that can fully charge in 9 minutes, as opposed to we're now looking under the couch for $200 billion in hopes of keeping gas prices below $150 a barrel. I mean, it's ludicrous. There's no thought here.
I didn't get
writing
you started.
Program, did I? Writing program. It's a writing program.
So in any event, we do host them, and they're not that young because in order for them to be invited,
they've got to be published.
They have to be published, and so there's been a great number of people that have come to the farm, and then they will sometimes write something about it when they get back.
Isn't that nice?
Well,
anybody under 50 now deserves my scornful envy. You know, I have to put that out. Do you get a chance to read much of what they do? Do you, with the after the fact, do you follow their careers?
I'm not a big reader. Yeah. I'm a big audiophile. You know, audio ergo sum kind of thing is me because I like to listen to podcasts. In fact, my mind races at night, so I have it running all the time, it seems. But I like to listen to a lot of the New York Times and public radio podcasts, and so you learn something new all the time whether you're reading or listening to something new.
You mentioned audio ergo sum, and that was a WVIK bumper sticker back in the day. Do you know the origins of that by any chance?
No, who wrote that?
Well, I was traveling. I don't know if it was for the college or might have been. I don't know. But I saw a bumper sticker in a German-speaking place that said, Ich höre, also bin ich, which translates as instead of, you know, like Voltaire's, as I hear, therefore I am. And I thought, you know, I told Don, I said, we should just do a bumper sticker that says, I hear, therefore I am. But of course, that wasn't classy enough for Wooten.
Yeah.
So he flipped it over to Latin, audio ergo sum, and there we go.
And now you've transitioned to your German side. So
there
are
you
going
to
talk about Germany?
Well, sure we are, but I don't want it to be too travelogue-y here. But Jack and Michelle and my spouse, Jenny, and I had a singular experience last fall. We went on a bike ride together from Passau, which is where the Danube flows into Austria, all the way down to the city of Krems. They didn't want us to ride all the way into Vienna for, I'm sure, liability's sake of riding
traffic,
exactly. But it was really an extraordinary experience. And you know what, Jack? That was last September. I don't think you and I have had a chance even to swap photos. Did you have fun on that trip?
It was great fun, and
yeah.
It was late September,
yeah.
So you have to remember how far north we are. Here in Davenport, if you were in Europe and you're on the same latitude, where would you be? Well, if you were in Rome, you would be north of Clinton, and if you were in Vienna, you would be in Thunder Bay, Canada. So in terms of the length of the days, we're getting shorter. It was beginning to get cool, and it's after kind of the high season. A lot of places that we rode by looked like they'd be great festival sites and taverns in the summer months, but not so much in September. However, it was a grape harvesting time. And sometimes grape harvesting weather. I was amazed that these are all small family plots and the family comes out, but that they can only cut the grapes when it's not raining.
And first off, they do a lot to protect small farmers there that we don't do. We choose to support big ag, and that, you know, is a different policy choice. But riding through those arbors and vineyards and so forth, because it was harvest time, I don't know if you noticed this. I've been in Europe in the summer, but never this time of year. They were ripening, and so it smelled like a wine shop as we were riding through some of those vineyards. And my spouse is more of a wine enthusiast than myself, so it was heaven for her. But it was great. I enjoyed the fact that it wasn't thronging with tourists. It was pretty nice to have those paths to ourselves.
It certainly was. We were all by ourselves riding along a river. You know, it's a river level trail. So it was a flat trail along the Danube, and we didn't do the entire part without having a bus take us some of the way, but very scenic and very pleasant time to be riding along the Danube.
What was most, I think, enlightening to me is how much respect and care is given by motorists to bicyclists. You'd be on a narrow little lane where the path was on a country road, and there was a tractor coming up behind you or a vehicle. There was none of this crowding you, honking, trying to get around. They just waited until there was a convenient place to pass, and there they went. They looked out for bikers. All the things that I don't see happening when I'm riding around Western Illinois and Eastern Iowa. Most recent ride up to Scott County Park almost got brushed off the road by some big SUV. I had to remind myself when I got back here, okay, remember, it ain't like there.
It's different most places. If you travel outside the United States, Canada, and Europe, the cars will stop and wait for you to decide if you're turning right or left mm-hmm. as a pedestrian from the sidewalk
yeah.
before they decide if they're going to enter the intersection. So
right.
it's not a hazardous place to walk or ride a bicycle.
Now, I elicited laughs from our small group because I said every day was the best day of the trip. But did you have a highlight that stood out for you?
Our friends that were with us, we were trying to keep our top 47 days because
yeah.
we have this thing, Kai's like, this has got to be the top 15 days, one of my top 15 days ever. So we expanded it. So we've got maybe 47 days that we keep on that list.
But... best bike rides, my top list of bike rides. And I stand by it.
Okay.
There were about six rides that were now a part of my top 10. They were great.
It's
but
a
did
lot
you
of
have
fun.
Did you have a particular experience?
Well, I enjoyed all of that. I was going to transition over. I've done several rag rides.
Yes, yeah.
And I see Tom Rav is coming back. I've never done a Tom Rav. I don't know if you've done one.
I have two.
Yeah.
Two of them.
And that looks like it's a little bit more challenging than the average rag ride day, though.
Yeah. So it's called the Tour of the Mississippi River Valley. And they will even, the Quad Cities Bicycle Club, so check out their website, qcbc.org, Quad Cities Bicycle Club. They have a training suggestion that you can follow starting now and getting rides in over the weekend and a little bit longer. And it's totally doable. I'm just going to be unavailable when this year's ride, which I think is June 6th, I think it's the first Saturday in June. But I highly recommend it. The first day is long, about 108 miles. You can take a shorter route, but you see some beautiful countryside. I understand that due to construction on the Illinois side of the river, the entire route's in Iowa this year. It used to go up through Galena, across the state line into Wisconsin, around the Cincinnati Mound, and then drop back down into Dubuque. But you still get to spend the night in Dubuque, and Loras College puts on a big feast for everybody, so I can't speak highly enough of it. But I do want you to know that one of my highlights from this trip was getting to the castle ruins above Dürnstein, and I had seen them going by on a boat. I always said, someday I'm going to climb up there. And
isn't that where Richard the Lionhearted was imprisoned?
You got it. Absolutely. Absolutely. And just to be in a place that, you know, Richard the Lionheart doesn't even exist in my mind. It's just a legend, right? It's like Arthur, you know, there couldn't have really been such a person. Well, there was. And he got locked up there for a while, held hostage. But the other thing was, it was eventually destroyed in the 30 Years' War by overzealous Swedish cannoneers. Who got that far away from Stockholm and blew the place to smithereens. But it's still something worth seeing. Any highlights like that?
Well, I was going to say with regard to RAGBRA, I've done about six of the mm-hmm. 52, but I've abandoned my bicycle in favor of walking with my dogs because I've got two golden retrievers. They're 6 years old. They have come to the office, law office, with me every day.
I've met them.
And we just got done with a 27-day trek down through southwest part of the United States, and we did 250 miles of hiking with the dogs in whether it was Palm Springs, Mojave Desert, along the rim of the Grand Canyon, yeah. Petrified Forest, Painted Desert, lots of places I hadn't been to for a long, long time, and many places we didn't get to. People are saying, you have to go to Death Valley. And Americans don't really go to Death Valley. Europeans do.
Mm-hmm.
All the cousins, we've got cousins from Europe, and they were like, we've got to go to Death Valley. Mm. But right now, it's in full bloom, mm-hmm. very unusual. And we saw some pictures of that in the paper, said that would have been good. But
next time.
We'd need another three or four Februarys to get that in.
Well, how is it traveling with two dogs? I know we used to travel with a tiny little dog, and there was no question of hiking, because after 30 meters, that dog was being carried. But how is it traveling with two dogs like that and doing those amazing hikes?
The dogs are great travelers. They've never complained one bit, and they're in the back of the SUV, and then we picked up another couple that are friends from Minneapolis, St. Paul, that were in Austria with us on the Danube trip. We picked them up in Albuquerque, and they were with us for a couple weeks as we went from Albuquerque. We went up to see Chris Merrill, the retired head of the International Writing Program up in Santa Fe. That's Painted Desert, and the Grand Canyon, Prescott, Phoenix, Palm Springs, went out to Temecula, California, and then back through the Mojave to Las Vegas, where we went to Red Rocks. It was very, very good.
I'm about to take a trip with two of my children, and you have also, in addition to traveling with dogs, you've traveled with your kids. Which one's easier?
Well, it's always fun to plan a trip, and it's more fun to complete the trip, and we've done a lot of those. I tell you, when Fred Berger's wife, Shirley, was a school teacher, she was a librarian at JB Young, and as I started practicing law, I was kind of amazed that they would take spring break, and I said, when I have children, I'm going to take spring break. So starting when our oldest, Calvin, who's here in the Quad Cities, working at the Arsenal now, he was in kindergarten. So we took spring break that year, every year until the youngest was in college. And so every year we'd go places that people don't necessarily go, Victoria, British Columbia. Of course, some of it was Florida and some, but Natchez Trace. Washington, D.C. in the springtime is just beautiful. We hit the cherry blossoms right once, and so it's just great to take a week and set it aside and fill it.
And you guys have done some amazing trips together. Tell me about New Zealand. You went there not too long ago.
Well, it's been 12, 13 years now.
That long?
Yeah,
really?
It was 2013.
I'm getting old.
And we enjoyed that, and we people that I talked to, they said, well, did you go here? Did you go there? And I said, we only went to one area, and that's in the Southern Island. We went to Queenstown and Tianu. And Queenstown is the home of adrenaline sports, I would say. That's where bungee jumping was invented. That's where the jet boats were invented. And they do a lot of hang gliding and other adrenaline sports down there. But the thing about it is it could have been named, every place there could have been named by Donald Trump.
Oh my goodness!
Because the Scots that settled down there used all these superlatives, and they were trying to get their cousins to come from Scotland. So the beautiful mountains there are called the Remarkables, and Paradise Valley there is where they filmed some of the Hobbit. And
got it.
And they have the Great Treks, and so if of the Great Treks, these are longer hikes that you can do over the mountains down in New Zealand. About five of them are in that area. Yeah.
Well, I'm getting so engrossed in the conversation, I totally forgot. We've got to have our guest join us now, none other than Roald Tweet, because we're a few minutes late, but it's never too late.
Is there time to call 309-794-7500?
Yeah, but don't do it while Tweet's on.
Okay.
Wait till he's done. We'll be right back.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. No sooner had the dust of the Civil War settled than the fledgling cities around Rock Island decided to make something of themselves in this world. That meant not only business and industry, but culture. For the city of Rock Island, it meant the Harper House. Ben Harper, a former mayor of Rock Island, determined to build the finest hotel on the rail line between Chicago and the West Coast, to show visitors, Harper said, that we have enterprise here and faith in the future. The Harper House opened in 1871 with a 1,200-seat auditorium. It was the first hotel in the West to have fire escapes. The auditorium provided a platform for international celebrities such as Mark Twain, Sarah Bernhardt, Buffalo Bill, Susan B. Anthony, and Tom Thumb, who all played to packed houses. Other visitors met a more mixed reception. On the last Sunday in April, 1882, the famous English aesthete Oscar Wilde arrived to speak on the English Renaissance. Wilde had not yet written The Picture of Dorian Gray, but he had been roundly satirized in a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta as the leader of an art for art's sake movement, and his approaching visit was widely anticipated. Local papers were not so positive following the lecture. The audience, said the Rock Island Daily Union, was more select than numerous, and his lecture, in which he attempted to bring the artist and the working man together in the struggle for the beautiful and the best, was reported only after a detailed account of his dress. He was sufficiently animated, the reviewer wrote, but his hair was affectedly long, and his costume was more 18th-century courtier than present-day gentleman. He wore a black velvet coat with a purple silk lining, lace ruffles at the wrists, a handsome seal dangling from his watch guard, and black silk stockings revealing huge calves. Rock Island was not impressed. Wilde's reception illustrates a point it is still well to notice. When we Rock Islanders advise prospective visitors to dress for the climate, we're not just talking temperature.
Rock Island Lines with Roll Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And is only available to you thanks to WVIK, whether on air or in the podcast section of the website. And it's there because folks like you have made this station possible. Give us a call at 309-794-7500 or online at wvik.org. Wanted to make space for Tweet, but that is giving us precious little time with Jack Dane, my guest. Now, you mentioned you've been invited by the Russian government to give a presentation on Iowa to some of their diplomatic folks, and you're probably going to have an hour or two to do that, but now we've got a minute or two. How do you encapsulate Iowa for a foreign audience like that?
Well, I think you have to tell them about it's about people. There's a lot of different European cultures mostly that are represented in Iowa and try to maintain that heritage. So talk a little bit about that, the natural features of effigy mounds. It would be nice if Iowa was all prairie state again, but it's 63% corn and soybeans. So it's kind of the same landscape, a lot of big ag influence in Iowa these days.
Well, as you know, many of our European friends are fascinated by the history of the indigenous persons who once had this land and took such good care of it. Is that part of your story?
Well, I think because I'll be on Zoom, right behind me will be my favorite painting, which is a painting of Black Hawk and his son, who you have honored with your work. His son is Loud Thunder.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a painting from the Gilcrease Museum in Tulsa, where my wife is from.
And at least the last time I went there, the National Portrait Gallery has a beautiful, it's along with about 30 other portraits in a mosaic, but of Nassaskuk, who was the name of Whirling Thunder, or Loud Thunder, as is sometimes rendered. And of course, you have to look a little further, but also there at the gallery, you'll find Maktay Meshekyak, who is Black Hawk.
Yes.
I haven't seen there Ashwekwa, which was his wife, which is rendered as Singing Bird. But yeah, you can definitely tell them all about those great folks.
Yeah, after the Black Hawk War, when he was a prisoner, Black Hawk was taken out to Washington and dressed up in a tuxedo or black suit. And so he appears as a modern-day gentleman while his son Loud Thunder in this painting is in war paint.
Right, and he was really... I think, a very accomplished warrior. That's how he got his name, because when he went into battle, it was whirling thunder. Well, Jack, I really appreciate you taking some time to be here. I'm going to put you through your paces here, and tell me, what is the phone number folks should call if they want to make a pledge of support?
Well, that would be 309-794-7500.
Jack, thank you very much. And of course, that's going to have to do it for this week, but we'll get you back here from time to time. Next week, our guest will be Jen Lewis-Snyder from the Quad Cities Cultural Trust. Thanks for being with us on The Conversation on WVIK.
You've been listening to a rebroadcast of The Conversation on WVIK. If you liked what you heard, you can catch new episodes on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. or back here again next Monday. Thanks for listening. Support for WVIK comes from Hack Augie, inviting local college and university students to a 24-hour hackathon April 18th and 19th. This competition is designed for developers, designers, business students, and hackers of all kinds. Register by March 22nd at www.hackaugie.com.
I'm Joe Immel from Charlotte, Iowa, and WVIK is my NPR station.
Count on us for news and talk 24 hours a day. WVIK, 90.3 FM and HD Rock Island, and 95.9 FM K240 DZ Dubuque. WVIK is Quad Cities NPR.